introduce yourself and just tell us how you ended up working in this area and especially on this crop, that'd be great. And then we can get into it.
Sure. You can see all the slides all right?
Yes, perfect.
Yeah, super.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, nice to meet you all. This is really cool to chat to a group of food security people, because normally I sort of try and talk a bit about what of agro biodiversity and food security is first off. But, you know, I'm preaching to the converted, hopefully, already. So I'm a research fellow at Kew. My background is in sort of conservation and genetics. But as my talk will kind of eventually get to, it's quite hard to do conservation unless you sort of have food security in the first place. So really, we're sort of going back to the basics of food security in a lot of the projects we're kind of working on. And I'm mostly going to talk about Ethiopia and NSAID and then broaden out a little bit to some of our kind of wider projects. So this is a beautiful photo from the Gamo Highlands in Ethiopia, completely different to what you might picture as Ethiopia, at least what I was picturing, something much drier and more arid when I started this work. So I'm going to start with bananas. Bananas, you're all familiar with bananas. You probably had it for breakfast. It's probably one of the world's most successful fruits. Originated in Southeast Asia, 100 million tons a year exported. It's in over 100 countries. Incredible. You know, this fruit has absolutely dominated the world. This is what a banana looks like. It's quite familiar to everyone, even in an ornamental setting. Everyone knows what a banana is. Bananas, we actually eat two species and hybrids of those two, and with maybe a little bit of introgression from a couple of other species. But if and within Musa, the genus, there's actually 60, 70, maybe 80 species, and they're all from Southeast Asia. But there's two other little groups in the Musaceae. One is Musella, which is a sort of monotypic, and it's exactly kind of halfway in its traits. It's called the golden lotus banana. That's from China. And then the other is NSAID. NSAID's a little bit more unusual. There are four NSAIDs in Asia. But at some point when the world was slightly differently orientated in terms of its continents, and it was perhaps slightly more humid, the NSAIDs made it to Africa. So there are real bananas in Africa. There's four species. Incidentally, two are critically endangered. And this is what NSAID in Africa looks like. The one I'm talking to you about is NSAID ventricosum, which means swollen sides. And you can probably see from these massive photos, they look a bit like bananas. When they were first described by a guy sort of called Cheeseman, they were called the giant bananas. That was the first kind of name for them. And that's really quite a good description. They're like bananas, but just enormous, 10 meters tall, a meter across. And they have a few interesting innovations, like an underground corm, which can help, potentially help them get through seasonal times of year. So NSAID, the crop, is remarkable. It has NSAID ventricosum in the green color on the map there, has a very wide distribution all the way from Ethiopia down to northern South Africa. But what's a bit weird about it is that it's only ever been domesticated in one very small region of Ethiopia, maybe about 300 kilometers by 200 kilometers. But in that tiny region, it is the absolute staple. It's not some crop they just happen to grow. It is the staple. In a recent fieldwork, we did 1,300 farms. Every single farm grows a large amount of NSAID, and it feeds about 20 million people. And that's doubled in the last 20 years, from 10 to 20 million. So it's incredibly important. I should just say where it gets its name. It's also known as the false banana. And that's because it does indeed look like a banana. Those orange ones in the are what it produces. Those are a little short. It does produce longer ones that look even more banana-like. But they're very disappointing, because if you were to eat them, you would find that they contain very large, big black seeds like that, almost no flesh. And so it is in fact not the fruit that is the useful part of this plant. It's actually the entire pseudostem and underground corm that is ground up into a pulp, fermented, and then eaten. A little bit about that. So in the left there, you can see it in the wild. In the wild, it's considered inedible, except in kind of absolute extreme famine. If you turn that into food, it's called devil's cocho, because it comes out black and it's very bitter. So people, we don't know when. Any numbers you see in any papers that say when it was domesticated are wrong, because no one has any idea whatsoever. We're really interested in understanding that, but potentially quite a long time ago. And they've converted it into basically a field crop that is enormous. It's more sun tolerant, a few various changes. And this is just a few of the photos of processing it. The guy in the top left there is using some of the midribs for cattle in the dry season. The lady in the middle is pounding up one of the corms. You can see that would have been big and round, and she's pulverizing it into a pulp. The pit on the bottom is where it gets fermented. On the right, you've got the gancha, which is a fiber, which is a byproduct of processing. So everything is used except pretty much the fruits. That's the only bit that isn't used, which ironically is the opposite of bananas. And it's worth just showing you can see a big corm in the middle there, and you can see it being fermented in that pit there. And very handily, I happen to have some of the food product just here. This is cocho. That pulp would be baked. And if you could smell it, it's really, really, really cheesy. I've had this stuff a little while now, but it stores really well. And cocho is the main food source. And there you can see cocho around there. And it would be traditionally served with raw meat if you're wealthy, or milk and cabbage if you're not so wealthy. That's what the crop is. It's quite interesting if you're sort of used to field crops or tubers to actually envisage what a field of enset looks like, because it can be 10 meters tall. You can't see the house. It's nice and cool underneath, and it's often intercropped with other things like coffee and yams and benefiting from the shade. And there you can see in the top, enset. So this region of Ethiopia is extremely population dense, one of the highest rural population densities in Africa. And actually they have very, very complicated management of enset. It's not just grown. The one-year-old plants are in one place, the two-year-olds in another, the three-year-olds, and the spacing gets progressively wider. So it's actually very, very efficient space management. So near the bottom, you can see smaller plants, and near the back, you can see larger plants. Also very dependent on manure from livestock. So it's a fascinating plant in itself. The real major assets of it is that because it's perennial and it keeps growing up until 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, when it would eventually, as a monocarp, flower and die. As long as it's harvested before that, you're good. But the real asset is that you can harvest it at any time, and you can plant it at any time. It's clonally propagated, so you can rapidly multiply genotypes that are really favorable, that you really like, that have the traits that you want. And what it means is, if you harvest at 5 or 6 years old, in a bad year, you can harvest a little more. In a good year, you can harvest a few less of your enset, and potentially buffering the variability in the availability of other crops, but also buffering seasonal events. It's putatively drought tolerant. So really, it's acting like a green asset that allows you some flexibility. And the fact that the products store in the fermentation pit for a long time, you can open that out, take some out, eat it, cover it back up. And then the finished product also stores. Basically, for a subsistence farmer, this is just maximum flexibility. And as far as we're aware, there are very, very few crops that give you that flexibility. There are other perennials, but a perennial fruit tree is also ready at a certain time of year. You know, this can be fully harvested and consumed at any point. And you can even boil the corm and eat it raw. But people tend not to do that because they prefer it fermented as cocho. But the really remarkable thing from a genetics perspective is the diversity of enset. So you can see a few different sort of sizes and shapes and colors here. You can see the red one, that's traditionally used for medicine. There are several red ones. But the really spectacular thing is quite how diverse it is. So in my talks, where people might not know what land races are, I give the sort of example of apples. How many apples could you name in a supermarket? How many could you identify in an orchard? How many could you identify? Maybe a handful, you know, Cox, Braeburn, whatever. But enset land race diversity is absolutely spectacular. We know of more than 1,500 different named varieties so far. That is confounded quite a lot by the fact that there's about 60 different language groups in the region where it grows. So our presumption was that there's a lot of vernacular duplication. But after sequencing a lot of those land races, actually we find them pretty much all to be different. And we find certain traits such as cocho quality, fiber quality, medicinal value, disease tolerance or resistance. There is a disease that people are particularly worried about. We find those cluster phylogenetically, even among land races that originate from very different ethnic groups. That's quite remarkable. On a typical farm, you get 7 or 8 land races. That's the sort of mean, but we've seen up to 20, 22 land races on a single farm. And what's really cool is that the farmers will specifically tell you that I maintain this diversity because it has lots of different uses. Some are tolerant to porcupines eating them, some are disease tolerant, some are drought tolerant. Some have even told us in lots of different languages on lots of different occasions that they deliberately try to, if they see a land race they don't know, they'll cultivate it on their farm, they'll assess it, they'll decide if it's any good. If it behaves well, they'll propagate it and they'll grow more. And if it doesn't, they'll leave it. So they're really managing this agrobiodiversity in a very, very clever, quite knowledgeable way. I've got a PhD student with Biodiversity International doing a really nice piece of work showing that over the last 30-odd years, after there've been lots of drought events in this part of Ethiopia, and after drought events, after long-term drought events, we see an increase in the amount of insect cultivated. And after more sort of mesic periods, we see a little bit of a decrease in insect. And so it seems to be an insurance crop that people tend to resort to. And potentially that's why, it could be one reason why insect is popular or became domesticated in this region of Ethiopia, because it's potentially had a lot of drought events. It's quite a variable region of the world, depending on if different monsoons happen to catch it in different years. We know a little bit about lots of other aspects of insect through various collaborations. It is predominantly a starch crop. Lots of people say, is it nutritious? Has it got lots of protein? Not really. Does it taste good? A little bit iffy. But it is high in calcium, zinc, and iron. And these bar charts just show it in comparison to other regionally available crops. But I should say that this is based on, you know, 30 odd plants, but there's some amazing diversity there. And so we don't think we've probably characterized much of it at all. And it probably depends a lot on soils and other management conditions as well. But what we would say is we find a lot of variation. And where there's variation, there's the opportunity to select the land races that meet certain purposes or certain needs. So there is a lot of diversity in insects. And then we had a recent paper that maybe people saw in the news. We don't know why they got excited about this particular one, but it's always nice when people are interested in insect. And that's really exploring a couple of things. It's, why is insect restricted to this very, so you can see the yellow hash on the top left there in Ethiopia. That's its domesticated range. But in the wild, it occurs all the way down through sort of the East African highlands down to South Africa. The short answer is we don't know why, but there's a couple of hints. So one is that the region around where insect is grown isn't really suitable for it. It is an island, and you have then much hotter arid areas in eastern Ethiopia, in northern Kenya, South Sudan to an extent, Egypt. But potentially it struggled to emerge from that region. And it might be because it had a lot of indigenous knowledge associated with it. I can't really give you an insect and say, eat it. You know, you need all of that knowledge associated with it. The other thing is looking at the potential for expansion within Ethiopia. We do find that there's quite a lot of climate resilient expansion potential in Ethiopia, which is quite a feasible target. One of the challenges for insect is that it's basically a poor person's crop. And a lot of investment has gone into cereals because people see a cereal-based diet as a Western-based diet, and they see that as desirable, understandably. And so insect has really struggled to be on the agricultural transformation list for Ethiopia. It's struggled to have national research attention because it's only found in one region, and Ethiopia is very federal. But that is now changing a little bit. And one of the best impacts we hope that our work and our collaborations with Ethiopia can do is to raise the profile of NSET and at least give it a fair shot at being improved just the same as other Ethiopian crops. There is some evidence that 200 or 300 years ago, NSET was once cultivated much more widely in northern Ethiopia. James Bruce in 1780, the first sort of Western explorer to send back drawings of plants and landscapes, showed NSET on the lakes, on the shores of the lake in northern Ethiopia. We don't really find it there now, a handful of plants, but it's not really a crop there anymore. And there's some suggestion that that was due to a major disease outbreak about 100 years ago. But really, we have almost no information. We're hoping we can try to solve that with a bit of genetics. More widely, The idea of expanding NSET, there've been some sort of discussions in Zambia and in a few other countries. The major challenge is that Ethiopia, rightly so, is extremely protective, one of the most protective countries in the world on its biological resources. And exporting any material, any permanent export of material is forbidden. So there's talk about re-domesticating NSET in other countries, which I think would be a lot of sort of effort when the plant is already there. But there is potential, it would be an Ethiopian decision, and we're really trying to lay out the potential for doing that. Where could it be suitable? And we've focused not just on the kind of climatic niche, but also on the sort of socioeconomic need. Where is the scenarios where we have no irrigation, high population densities, low agrobiodiversity, seasonal food insecurity? Where are the situations where NSET could really fill a niche? So that was a nice piece of work we're looking to continue in the future. The other area, sort of perhaps the main focus of our work, is helping Ethiopian farmers adapt. So they tend to grow, as I said, 7, 8, 9 different land races, but many of the land races are very highly localized to that area. And it's probably the same that's been grown for 50 years, 100 years, perhaps several hundred years. And what we know is that Ethiopia has already warmed by 1.3 degrees. So climate change isn't this thing that's gonna happen that we model, it's this thing that's already happened. And so a big part of our work is trying to understand how those land races are locally adapted to those climates using big genome environment models. And then trying to ask the question about which land races could be future adapted to that location. We did a lot of this work on birch trees in the UK, which is much more kind of tractable. And we're trying to kind of apply this model in Ethiopia. And we're trying to basically envisage what would sort of assisted migration or assisted gene flow look like. And in practice, what that would be is that would be suggesting new land races to farmers that both meet their needs in terms of taste, desirability, and so on, but also are potentially adapted to future climate. And that wouldn't be sort of putting all your eggs in one basket and saying, this is the one for you. We're trying to build into that genetic variation, you know, and the uncertainty of our models as well. And it goes without saying that those kind of adaptations, they're quite challenging for you. You know, having access to those other land races would be the other major obstacle. But the nice thing about NSET is it grows over about 2000 meters elevational range. So in a lot of parts of the country, there are potentially land races that grow in warmer environments, lower down, that could be future climate adapted to where those farmers are. But this is a big challenge. The other thing I would just say is that NSET is a clonal crop. It's propagated by taking a 2 or 3 year old plant, cutting the top off, scraping out the eye, and the eye is probably the meristematic material right in the middle of the pseudostem. Covering it over with manure, and then you get hundreds of suckers emerge. And those suckers are clones. It doesn't do it naturally. Bananas do that almost sort of naturally. They send out pups. NSET doesn't do that. But farmers have developed a way of making them, manipulating the plants through stress into doing that. And those suckers are then broken up and propagate. So you can very rapidly multiply favorable genotypes. But we found two things. One is that domesticated NSET only retains about a third of the diversity in the wild populations. So there's a big unknown over the state and the situation of wild populations in Ethiopia, and more widely, very, very little known about these plants. They're quite highly localized. And the other thing is that we see an accumulation of deleterious mutations because there's no recombination, or very, 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 very little recombination. So potentially, well, we've got tons and tons of questions, but at some point, it's difficult to imagine that domestication involved spontaneously identifying this plant, developing a clonal propagation method, and developing fermentation. These things probably happened in a stepwise fashion. And what we'd really like to know is when and why sexual reproduction stopped happening and farmers shifted entirely to clonal propagation. And it's not like some other systems like manioc, I think, where we're pretty sure quite a bit of sex is going on. It's absolutely exclusively clonal propagation. The plants aren't allowed to flower because that would reallocate energy to your inflorescence. So they're harvested before that. I've seen about 7 or 8 flowering domesticated plants in the whole time I've worked there. So it's really, really uncommon. And that complete shift to clonal propagation potentially stores up genetic challenges for the future. So that's an area we're really, really interested in. Whether it happened like this two-stage thing I'm describing now, we don't know, but that's an area we're really excited about. So to talk a little bit more widely, I think NSAID's great. I think it's the best thing since sliced bread. But of course, it is just one of many, many, many underutilized crops. And some work at Kew over the last couple of years, there's more than 7,000 species that we know humans do eat or have eaten, many of them highly localized like NSAID, but only a handful are considered crops. And even fewer of those are really global crops that are tracked by the FAO or something like that. So actually, the portion of agrobiodiversity that we rely on and know about is very, very narrow. In fact, the species that are considered crops are actually spatially very, very biased, understandably, towards temperate zone crops that have spread around countries that have had agricultural revolutions very early on. But there's other regions like Africa on the left there that actually has perhaps the highest diversity of edible crops. So we know that the species we use are very spatially biased. We also know that the species we used are very phylogenetically biased. You know, all our major crops are all from one tiny branch of the angiosperm tree. So one of the things we're really interested in is how we can try and conserve that agrobiodiversity at the same time. It's worth pointing out that we know loads about where biodiversity is. As long as by biodiversity, you basically mean mammals and birds. I like birds, a bit of a bird watcher, but you know, it's amazing what we know about birds considering we barely eat any of them. And it's amazing how little we know about plants, considering how fundamental they are to everything we do. By comparison, we know a little bit about the distribution. Where is agrobiodiversity? But as I said, so the previous map was just occurrence. It wasn't cultivation. But actually, where is our agrobiodiversity? You know, where should we conserve it? Actually, we know quite little. And to give an example, we have some fantastic indices tracking global biodiversity loss, but we have almost nothing similar for tracking agrobiodiversity loss. And of course, preaching to the converted with this audience probably, but we continue to talk about agriculture as the greatest threat to biodiversity, but actually agrobiodiversity, agriculture, it's actually the greatest solution as well, because doing agriculture well gives us all that space and time and energy to do conservation. So this is another reason why Ethiopia is potentially a really interesting case study. It's probably, I get sometimes told off by West African people when I say this, but it's probably the most important center of crop domestication in sub-Saharan Africa. We've got, you know, coffee, NSAID, many types of yam, teff, noog, Ethiopian potato, anchote. There's an awful lot of crops that come from the Ethiopian highlands. It's also part of a biodiversity hotspot, and it's also a linguistic diversity hotspot. So one of the things we're very interested in is whether the same processes are driving all three of those types of biodiversity. And so we've been assembling information on linguistic diversity, farm agrobiodiversity, and wild biodiversity. Just looking at NSAID, one thing that's quite exciting is that when we look at spatial patterns of landrace diversity, in terms of their name, we actually find they're very concordant with patterns of genetic diversity, which is as a proxy for genetic diversity, that's quite encouraging in the first place. When we look a little bit wider, we're really interested in whether the same things are driving wild diversity, agrobiodiversity, and linguistic diversity. And we find two main things. First, it's that basic climatic things like length of the growing season and seasonality. They seem to drive all three of those types of biodiversity. And with structural equation modeling, we've tested whether actually they're interacting, but we do think they're all being fundamentally driven by climate. And the other thing is poverty. Poverty seems to drive down wild biodiversity through exploitation. It seems to drive down agrobiodiversity, often through accessibility to crops. And it seems to drive down linguistic diversity as well. Sorry, my screen is muddling up there. And so when we lay those three things over each other, we find all three types of biodiversity very, very hot in the Southwest. Now, that's really exciting to find concordance between different types of biodiversity. I'm calling language a type of biodiversity. But it also begs the question is whether there's conflict or whether there's competition between those. We want areas of agrobiodiversity, but we also want areas of wild biodiversity for conservation. And so that's the other area we're working on. You might have heard of important bird areas, which have been done for all birds, KBAs, key biodiversity areas. One flavor of those is tropical important plant areas or just important plant areas. And they have been produced for very, very few countries. There's a big research program on that at Kew, and we're starting to develop them for wild biodiversity in Ethiopia. And the core of that is not about identifying essentially protected areas. It's actually about identifying very high plant biodiversity regions that have regional and national value. So useful plants that could be exploited, crop wild relatives, and so on. And so Ethiopia is a remarkable place for that. When we talk about sort of area-based conservation or in situ conservation, the other facet to think about is ex situ seed banks. Can we not, especially for crops, can we not just conserve all our biodiversity in gene banks? Well, I would say a couple of things. Firstly, NSET is pretty much useless, as an example, without the associated indigenous knowledge about how to manage it, how to grow it, how to cultivate it, how to process it, and how to consume it. How do you conserve those things alongside the seeds? The second thing is that in tropical countries, clonally propagated crops make up about half of what is of the species cultivated. Some species you can obviously do both, but for NSET, it's the clonal genotypes that the farmers prefer. As soon as you get seeds from a domesticated land race, it's 50% something else, and we don't know what that is. And so seed banking is really useful, but it probably doesn't address that gap. So we've started to look at is there a way of doing area-based conservation, but for crops? And there are a handful of examples around the world. The Peru Potato Park is a really nice example. IUCN Category 5, which is human or anthropogenic landscapes, is potentially a really nice example. And so we've been working on this in Ethiopia, looking at trying to map crop diversity as well as species that are in decline or are not conserved ex situ, but also proximity to wild gene sources. And to just give an example with the diagram on the right about why this is really useful, what we're trying to do is focus conservation of agrobiodiversity to the areas around existing patches of native vegetation. And the reason is that in NSET, we think that there is very small but a very important amount of gene flow between wild plants and the domesticated crop. In coffee, we know that there is an enormous amount of gene flow. In fact, the domesticated crop in some areas are basically just wild plants. And so that gene flow, that reservoir in NSET, there's three times as much genetic diversity in the wild. In coffee, it might be the same, we don't know. That's going to be really important for climate adaptation. And we're trying to target that support to farmers around that native vegetation so that we get the benefit of proximity to wild gene sources. And you might have heard of payments for ecosystem services. I guess the point here is that why should farmers conserve this biodiversity, seeing as it's a global benefit for us, but what necessarily is the benefit for them? They shouldn't pay the price of doing a global good. So we're trying to adapt the concept of payments for ecosystem services to payments for agrobiodiversity conservation services. Needs maybe a punchier name. And that is a project we're just starting this year, trying to support farmers to not lose land races, starting with things like NSET coffee yams, but potentially more widely. And there is some evidence that it works in places like Kaffa Biosphere Reserve. There's not an awful lot of native vegetation in Ethiopia. It's a very densely populated country. Most of it is farmland or pasture. But Kaffa is the home to an enormous understory of wild coffee. Ethiopia gets most of its foreign exchange from coffee exports. It appreciates how important coffee is to its economy. And so there's a really nice example in Kaffa Biosphere Reserve of intact forest being successfully conserved. So I'm just starting to wrap up now, and I would say that how does this link back to conservation more generally? So the two countries I work in mostly are Ethiopia and Madagascar, both with major food insecurity challenges, pretty much. And when we talk about conservation, most people in most countries, especially developed countries, think of conservation as this sort of no-brainer. Why wouldn't you sustainably manage your resources? You just need to plan for the future. They're irreplaceable. But in particularly subsistence agricultural settings where you have, you know, major seasonal food insecurity challenges, people have much higher priorities, and that is trying to ensure they have food security. And so we're really trying to bridge between the food security and the conservation kind of mindset to emphasize how many of these challenges need to be addressed first before people have the kind of latitude and energy and enthusiasm and interest to really start talking about conservation. Conservation in Ethiopia is, you know, a really long way away. Unsurprisingly, it has a massive university age part of society, right? Going to university is very, very popular. For every kind of conservation student you might meet, you'll meet 100 agricultural scientists. And that's because that really is the priority for a place like Ethiopia. And we do think that by trying to address things like zero hunger and health and well-being, it's foundational to addressing the other sustainable development goals. And so we really see it as working with people to try and help them adapt under climate change, under other challenges, to maintain agrobiodiversity. And agrobiodiversity is the key to conserving all of the rest of biodiversity. And I'll just wrap up by saying another couple of things. I thought I had a different slide. Yeah, there we go. We use a tiny proportion of the diversity of plant life. You know, we have pretty good evidence that in the past we've used many, many more, but there's whole clades where we use, say, one species, and there's many, many others that might be suitable, even better, particularly under climate change. And so we've spent a lot of time thinking, there's a lot of text on this slide, so don't read it all, but the point is we have quite a choice about how we kind of proceed in the next century. We could double down on the crops we grow. You know, we've got pretty good technology. There's like plant breeders in places like the John Innes Centre and Rothamsted and all that kind of stuff. We could make the crops we have better. That's probably true. We might be able to switch to a similar set of elite alternative crops that might be different species, but we can invest similarly in those. But at the same time, we could diversify what we're using, or we could continue to narrow it. And these kind of challenges, at the moment, we have a lot of options. We have a lot of choices, diversification, substitution, and so on. But if we keep eroding our agrobiodiversity and our wild biodiversity, our options are going to get much narrower, and they're going to be made for us. So really, we think, you know, conserving agrobiodiversity should be on an equal footing with this idea of sort of global biodiversity loss. There's a twin crisis going on at the same time. And whilst we might not feel we know much about wild biodiversity, we know a lot more than we do about most of agrobiodiversity. And when we think about sort of global biodiversity hotspots, we really want to look at how they overlap with agrobiodiversity hotspots. These are the Vavilov centers, but there may be other places that still that have very high agrobiodiversity that aren't very, very well known. And I will just say one last thing is that we existed as a species for tens of thousands or millions of years without agriculture. And then very quickly over the last kind of between 12 and 5,000 years, it popped up in a whole bunch of different places, probably independently, pretty quickly. And if you think about the timescale that we've been wandering around doing stuff as a species, it's quite surprising that it all happened so quickly. It's worth pointing out that that period when agriculture developed has been a period of rather climatic stability, if we look in the sort of long term over the last few 10,000 years. And so we developed agriculture, and now we have the largest population ever to feed. We've eroded biodiversity, and we're facing the fastest and most severe climate change that these ecosystems have experienced in thousands of years. So we have a pretty serious challenge over the next 100 years to keep to keep feeding everyone in the same way we have done for the last few hundred. So it's a pretty big challenge. So I just want to thank all the people, loads and loads of people, especially in Ethiopia, that and postdocs and PhD students that have worked on this data. There's a few papers there. And thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you, James. Thank you so much. Martin is also clapping. Thank you very much. It's really interesting research and work. And I wanted to just go back to NSAID very quickly, because you might have said it and I might have missed it. But what was the length of time that it plant last? Do you have to replace the trees, yeah, or do they go on and on?
They'll live depending on the climate. You know, some will flower in 7 years, some will flower in like 13 years. Most are harvested around 5 or 6 years old. But it depends a little bit on the area. And sometimes if you're not quite ready to harvest it, it can start sticking a flower spike out and people will cut it off.
You need more land. So my question led then to ask then, do you need more and more land to accommodate then more new trees?
Well, yeah, no, most people have half a hectare and they rotate what they have. So they'll always have some 4, 5, 6 year old trees. And in fact, a really good indicator of food insecurity in Ethiopia, you could have a lot of land and a lot of plants on it, but if you don't have any NSAID over sort of 3 or 4 years old, it means people are harvesting it kind of too young. And I've got a colleague who works on kind of food security indicators, you know, stunting and these kind of things. And they're actually really interested in satellite measures of mature NSAID, because they potentially indicate food insecurity issues before the outcome in the health of people.
Yeah, but can I then also clarify something else, James? So did you say then the NSAID from a nutritional point of view is not spectacular, doesn't provide lots of nutrients, or did I misunderstand?
It's a starch crop. Yeah, so it has carbohydrate and it mm-hmm. produces it in massive quantities, but it's not a balanced diet on its own.
Okay. So, I mean, the provocative question then could be, given that it is a plant that has been domesticated but is not widely popular and has its challenges, should then maybe Ethiopia and other countries then focus on other forgotten crops which also give more nutritional value?
Yeah, potentially. But I mean, you could have something that produces a lot of protein, like a legume, but it might not mm-hmm. be productive enough to give you all your carbohydrate and starch. So you need a combination. Mm-hmm. I think with NSAID, you have a kind of low-hanging fruit. There's probably quite good opportunities to improve it from the outset. We know not much about it. I think the statistic is 15 plants can feed a person for a year. So in terms of a hectares, we think it's pretty much the most productive crop mm-hmm. in Ethiopia.
Okay.
But you see a lot of these statements repeated a lot. So I haven't done that myself, so I couldn't tell you. But certainly people resort to it. Mm-hmm. NSAID occurs in the areas, you know, it's most common in the areas with the highest population density. Is that because, you know, it supports high population, or people in high population grow NSAID? You know, that's circular. It's slightly hard to know.
Mm-hmm. Sorry that a few have to sleep out because they had various things, that there are just a few of us left. But would anyone like to ask a question or make a comment, please? Ryan or Martin, Nicole? Ryan, please.
Muted.
How long have we been on Zoom? And there's always somebody.
I know. Topic.
Sorry. But no, that was really fascinating, James. I mean, there's so much. I have so many questions. So this might come off a bit half-baked, because I'm going to try and ask one question, but there's so many things going on.
Yeah.
So I part of it is, I guess, following up on what Francesca said. And I'm thinking about, the connection to bananas, I guess, is so striking. Yeah. And I work primarily in Latin America, so I'm thinking about, you know, the vast banana regions, and especially like the monocultures of bananas.
Yeah.
And the first part of that is, how would you envision sort of like the NSAID cropping systems, you know, being exported?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And the second part of that question then, which I guess is somewhat not necessarily DSI world, yeah. but in terms of the sort of like an indigenous knowledge, but also the benefits and benefit sharing with that. How do you envision? So that's sort of three things in one, but sort of globalizing it. Yeah.
So the first thing about globalizing, so we only modeled Africa because we thought that was reasonable. But the one thing I would say is that as a cultivated garden plant, NSET is in Central America, it's in Australia, it's in New Zealand, it's in the UK, it's everywhere. So the plant will grow pretty much anywhere. So you know, whether in a productive setting, I don't know. The second thing is about what would it look like? So what we're not saying is other people should adopt this as a staple, because that would be kind of mad. But what we see is NSET culture is like a bullseye in Ethiopia. So in the middle, it's people's life. Their ethnic group is named after NSET. They use it, build their houses with it. It's absolutely everywhere. That's the most of the region, but on the edge, over about a kind of 50K area, NSET goes from being absolutely completely everywhere to vanishing. And on that very periphery, what you tend to find is that people grow 4, 5, 6, 7, right? And they might not use them. They'll use the leaves for something, but they have them at the bottom of their garden. And it's basically an insurance policy. All they need to do is kind of repropagate those every kind of 4 or 5 years. They don't take up any space. And they have sort of co-benefits. But in a disaster, in a famine, that'll keep them going for a couple of months. And so we really envisage it as an emergency, as a famine crop. And in those settings, you might not need all of the indigenous knowledge, right? You could just eat the corn. You could boil the corn like a potato. Might not be the nicest thing ever, but it'll keep you going for quite a long time. The other option, which it's not something that really interests me or excites me, but there are people in Ethiopia looking at whether this can be a biomass crop. So there's no commercial growing of NSET at all. But it does produce masses of biomass. There's interest in whether it could be a major fiber crop as well. And so internationally, that's the sort of only other scenario I could see. In terms of benefit sharing, that's the major hot topic. You know, if you're interested in that whole thing, Google Ethiopia and TEF, which is their other really famous indigenous crop, and the legal battles in European court over a company that got some of the intellectual property for selling TEF, just a complete nightmare and a disaster. Ethiopia is very hot on sort of biopiracy. To be honest, I can't really see it happening. I can't really see them sharing it with anyone. But we're trying to be really clear that, you know, we're doing modeling, but basically it's Ethiopia's decision, right? But who knows what could happen in the future? I mean, Ethiopia benefits from, you know, maize, which came from South America. You know, I have quite a sort of liberal view of crops, but I would, because I've got a full stomach and I'm fortunate, you know, so.
Sorry, can I ask a quick follow-up, Francesca?
Yeah, of course, please.
Yeah, just really quick. I mean, so I guess sort of the takeaway here is not that, and you've sort of already said this, so I guess it's not too revealing, but it's not that NSET is some sort of like silver bullet or even, you know, this is the crop that countries should be looking at. It's really that NSET is really, you know, a case or a window into all of these other forgotten crops or underutilized crops, like maybe Babassu in Brazil, which is where I work.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so it's really like not just NSET, but all these other
crops. Absolutely. And every single journalist, so we get loads of journalists say, oh, I've heard there's a banana disease, TR4 or something. Can we come and talk about that? And we say, yeah, boring. Do you want to hear about NSET? It's like the same thing. And we then tell them about NSET. And every single one I say, look, it's really interesting. It's an awesome crop, but it's not a superfood. It's not a silver bullet. And every single time they then misquote me and say, Dr. James Burrell says NSET's a superfood. It's so annoying. It is just one crop. The only thing I would say about NSET that does make it better than all the others is this flexibility in harvest timing, right? The fact that you harvest the whole thing and, you know, it's like a green asset. And there's not many other crops like that. The closest analogy we can give is sago palm, because that does grow and grow and grow and grow, and you harvest the whole thing destructively and use it when you want it. But no one's kind of growing, as far as I know, kind of fields of sago palm around their house, you know. So there might be there's a legume in Africa that produces beans, and underground it also produces a yam-like tuber. And so you can use the beans as you're going along. Then if you really wanted to, you could dig up the tuber and eat all of that. So, but there's not many crops that have this flexibility. And that's, so we're saying one of many awesome crops. Let's develop these underutilized crops. But NSAID's got this tiny little extra special thing as well. That's what we're saying.
Yeah. You can call it the green pig because you use everything from it. Martin, Nicole, Daniel, who's just joined us, would you like to ask a question and make a comment, please?
Thanks for great talk, James. I'm an archaeologist, so that explains why I'm asking this question. Has anybody tried a molecular clock estimate of how old domestication was?
Not yet. So that's something we're really actively interested in. We have some samples now of multiple generations, or two generations, so a parent and its clone. And we want to understand how much changes between those generations. One thing we think is probably going on is what's called diplontic selection, which is, if I didn't know what this was, so apologies, people already know what this is. When you have all those suckers coming out of the corm, you're probably not taking them at random. You're probably taking the strong ones and the healthy ones. So there might actually be selection, even though we think of it as just clonal or high fidelity copying. So we don't really understand the mutation rate and the sort of rate of change. If it was just a sexual population, then using a molecular clock to kind of go back and date it would be a strategy. So we are looking at doing that. The other archaeological thing you might find interesting is we've just got a grant with Dorian Fuller at UCL, and which will be looking for evidence of phytoliths in cores in caves in parts of Ethiopia to try and understand how long NSAID has been consumed by people, and potentially put some dates on our kind of phylogenetic tree to understand a bit of that history.
Thank you. It did occur to me, if the cultivar has got a quarter of the genetic diversity of the wild, then it's not that recent. I mean, obviously, as you say, it's mentioned in generations rather than years, but that doesn't matter. I mean, for a cultivar to have a quarter of the
diversity of the wild
suggests quite an old domestication.
Well, but I could also argue that you could get that pattern. Unfortunately, you could get that pattern almost instantaneously as well. You know, if you have a population of 100 individuals and I take 25, and then I fix them as clonal genotypes and I maintain those 25, that 25% as a fixed genotype that essentially doesn't change, I could actually have just partitioned out a small amount of that genetic variation. The fact that it's
then you'd have a tinier genetic range, wouldn't you? Not a larger genetic range.
Possibly. So you're saying you're saying 25% is more than you
would large. Expect.
Yeah, well, so we know that
if you have a recent domesticate, you expect much less,
even smaller. Yeah,
much smaller.
Yeah,
yeah. And I mean,
so we do know that
25% seems to be,
quite a lot.
And to capture 25% of the variation, you can't have that recent domestication.
Yeah. So okay. We'd have to chat more. It's a really interesting one. Yeah,
I'll put you in touch. But I mean, following this, I mean, James, how do you work with the Ethiopian government? I mean, and the farmers' communities, and to also understand the traditional knowledge, and you know, in a way, also discovering what Marty has just pointed out.
Yeah, I mean, so we can't do anything on our own, because you know, in a single day, you could go to villages with four or five different languages, you know. So we work really closely with particularly Hawassa University and Addis Ababa University. You know, they're really fantastic. We have a pretty good relationship. You know, Q's been working with Ethiopia for about 30 years. So we have a lot of Ethiopian guests come and visit, spend a bit of time here. And I think that's really the best way for our partners to see how we work and what motivates us, is to try and come and spend time with us here. With visas and cuts to overseas development aid and all that kind of thing, it's tricky. Incidentally, all of this work was funded under GCRF, which has just been cancelled a couple of weeks ago. So that's a shame. But yeah, we work together.
And farmers groups, and, you know, to sort of find out the traditional knowledge and and in a way that knowledge that shows how long has been domesticated for, etc.
Yeah, well, in terms of how long it's been domesticated, I mean, farmers don't know, in my experience, anything about that. But they'll very happily talk about the attributes, and you know, they love to discuss the traits and the advantages of these things. And you know, all the data is Ethiopian. It's held by our Ethiopian partners. You know, we just work on it and collaborate with them and analyze it together. It is a minefield. But the risk is that no one does anything on these crops and then they vanish and then we don't know anything about them.
Mm. Yeah. Anyone else would like to ask a question or making a comment?
Cool. Well, really nice to chat to you all.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming and really nice to chat to you all. And
thank you, James.
Feel free to get in touch if you want to.
I'll put you in touch with Martin and Paul. You have more to talk, I'm sure.
Cheers.
Thank you very much. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Take care.